But I'll just do them by way of discussion, not as an analytical meditation. So the where we'd kind of got to, if I go back, remember we ended up with, in the session before, with Nagarjuna saying, everything's empty of inherent existence, of that over-concretized, over-solid kind of taking appearances for reality kind of way, by the very fact of dependent arising. You know, they're not empty of inherent existence because they're here functioning, but because they all arise and exist dependent on causes and conditions. And then if we went to get the summary of where we were, and you know, makes for a good kind of analytical reflection, meditative reflection, if you're ever turning it over in your own mind. The terms dependent and independent are a dichotomy. You know, if you think about it or look up the definition, it's a division or contrast between two things that are represented as being opposed or entirely different. So that anything that exists is either one or the other. But of course, dependent and independent are also relative to one another and in relation to other things. We can be more or less dependent on things. We can be dependent on things to a greater or lesser degree, but there's no absolute inherently existing existence, dependence or independence. So the idea that anything exists wholly independent on its own, not dependent on anything at all, singular, permanent, partless, completely self-sufficient, it's a kind of a fantasized notion of existence. Nothing exists that way, or for the matter, could ever exist that way. So when something is dependent, it must be empty of being wholly under its own power. Yeah? If something's dependent in any way, then you can't say, oh, it's wholly under its own power from its own side. So if we sort of apply that to ourselves in terms of mind and body, nowhere in the parts of the body and the mind that form the basis for us to use that personal pronoun, I, can we find anything that this pronoun refers to that's in any way separate from them, not in some way dependent upon them. Therefore, the I is not established under its own power by itself from its own side, but through the force of other conditions. And if you remember, they were three: its causes, its parts, and thought. It arises in dependence on that and then rightly labels whatever arises. So that's where we got to. Is everybody happy and clear about that one? You could do, the presentation here, and certainly from the point of view of I suppose in general Buddhist presentation really, but I'm being particularly careful about, was not to become involved in metaphysical questions about whether there may or may not be intelligent design in the universe. I personally want to remain completely agnostic about that. But I think there's still a way of relating to it. I mean, the one thing that we are clear about is that something that's straight up and down, as Alex Berzin's German mother would say, where Buddhism is concerned, there is no belief in a creator God. The question of intelligent design, if you like, in some form, is another matter, although the design may be taking it too close to the idea of a creator. it's interesting. So I was trying to sort of steer away from that.
Yeah.
But if, for example, you presupposed or assumed or had a belief for whatever reason, or a hankering or a fancy, that there may be some intelligent force driving the universe into that's separate to what you can see, some sort of supreme being, then what I'm talking about, just that's another dependency.
Mm.
Yeah, it's obviously dependent on being alive.
Mm.
That which drives life, yeah, that life force, if you like. But I don't want to reify that too much either. May or may not be intelligent, and certainly, but the experience we're having at the moment is dependent on it. If not, we'd be dead.
Yeah.
And so would everything else. Do you see what I mean? So,
yeah.
This presentation, from the Buddhist perspective, really leaves it to you about whether you want to say, well, I actually think that, you know, whatever it is, you know, we're all somehow nodes in a wider awareness that is itself intelligent and organises everything and constitutes some sort of supreme being.
Mm. Yeah,
but I mean, as soon as you go there, most Buddhists would say, no. Nah. But then we're in, it's a metaphysical question. I think what I'll start off by saying is that I am far from being a reductive materialist. In fact, I oppose reductive materialism. I think it is itself a religion, and there's very little evidence for it. Yeah, I think the people who... I understand why people want to go there, but I think they go too far and then make metaphysical assumptions that go way beyond the evidence. I would prefer they just say, we just want to stick with what we've got evidence for, not then say, so therefore... If you can't come up with something to the contrary, it looks to us as if reductive materialism is the only evidence-based thesis. And I'm saying you've already exceeded the scientific maxim. You are yourselves projecting and making a religion out of reductive materialism. I mean, I had a lot of admiration for Dawkins, but I think he went too far. He turned it into a new church, a new religion, and indeed undermined all his arguments against the forms of religiosity and religious thinking that he was trying to argue against. And I had a lot of sympathy with that. But so do you see where I'm going? So I need to put that up as a warning, as a caveat. But in terms of what's going on with the consciousness, how we've developed and how we fill in the gaps and how we've organized ourselves and how this evolutionary biology goes a long way to give you an answer to that without postulating any other intelligence. And that's not to say there isn't more than the story that evolutionary biology has, but I don't think we can ignore the story of evolutionary biology. Yeah. Does that kind of make sense? It's probably crude and brainstorming, but what's driving the evolution? That may be intelligent. Don't know. But I don't need to think of some other thing, or the eyeball knowing, or consciousness knowing, yeah. Consciousness in the conventional sense. Yeah, because when I was talking about, you know, your question was to the mark, when I'm talking about discontinuities in consciousness, in the same way there are discontinuities in visual and other perception, then how could you possibly be aware of the gaps, or what connects one moment of consciousness or another? At a conventional level, this is in the same way that we can, by identifying illusions and doing various funny things and scientific experiments, discover that there really are discontinuities in perception as far as conventional consciousness is concerned, we can discover discontinuities there too and see and demonstrate how consciousness itself makes up for the gaps by creating an illusion of a useful illusion of continuity. Yeah. But that's without prejudice to somebody said to me, oh, but what if awareness is like space? Yeah. And it's everywhere. And even apparently inanimate things are pervaded by awareness. Yeah, it's a possibility, but it's a metaphysical speculation. Mm-hmm. Does it kind of make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think from the point of view of thinking, with or without that, is it still clear to you or is it problematic that we still do take appearances for reality and then...
Yeah.
The metaphysical questions are interesting, but maybe don't kind of not necessary for this particular analysis. Yeah. And no, you don't. When people say, "Well, the Buddha taught, and Buddhists subsequently sort of pick up the view, oh, well, there's no creator God." I mean, that is just a belief. There's no way of proving or disproving the existence of God, particularly if you get very sophisticated on your understanding of God. It might be about all recognition. If someone tells me a story of an old man, vengeful old man, you know, and all of that, then it's quite easy for me to have a go at it. If someone talks about some intelligence pervading the universe that's a combination of wisdom and compassion or love, or what, then it's more difficult. And why would I want to in some ways? But what I'm saying is, can't prove it one way or the other. It's a genuinely metaphysical question. And they're interesting, and I kind of, as a philosopher by training, I quite like it. But I think when I see people arguing about it to the point of, you know, one must be right, one must be wrong, I'm thinking, it's a metaphysical question, you're never going to go there. But you can have quite an interesting dialectic, you know, in the same way that I can now actually speak with people of a theological bent, because I've got a much better understanding of what they're understanding by God than the one I was brought up with. And their understanding has moved on, and they've looked at other religions than their own in the East and so on and so forth, and so dialogue's possible. The Sufis are also interesting, really interesting, and of course within the Sufi community and traditions there are wide variations of opinion, in the same way there are within the Buddhist community really excellent debates about really finer points of emptiness. Yeah. And similarly within the Sufi community, I've only recently reading a very interesting book which is called Shams and Rumi's Silent Rebellion. And it's written by an Iranian and who became an academic and is sort of saying, well, hang on a minute, if I actually go back and look particularly at two really big texts that were not really admitted by the tradition post the Ottoman Empire, didn't really come out until the Mevlevi dervishes were disbanded by Ataturk, although they still survive. And also the kind of, at the time, I mean, when prior to Rumi and Shams, Mansur el-Halaj was saying, I am the truth and in my turban is wrapped nothing but God, they martyred him for his heresy. And similarly, Shams and Rumi, textual evidence, not some rumour or something passed on in the tradition, seem to be arguing for a much more radical non-dualism, and they also were clearly, I mean, not just inference, evidence, in Shams in particular, in discussion with Kashmiri Shaivites and Buddhists, and mindful of their situation, they were saying, how can we convey this teaching and go as far as we dare without stepping outside the boundaries of Orthodox Islam? And within the Sufi community itself, there's quite a lot of discussion and debate about that. And between the different orders of dervishes, quite different ideas, you know, and within the Sufis themselves, you know, there are Sunnis, all shades of Islam are kind of reflected there. And within those schools, discussions. So this sort of discussion would be pretty lively, I would have thought. Yeah. Yeah. But the Shams and Rumi one in this thesis, I'm reminded of, were more of what you're talking about. They would be saying, no, it's not about an agency. The divine, for them, the divine was love. It's a love as the force that drives things into being, yeah? Out of which everything comes. So then Islamic orthodoxy, and such Islamic orthodoxy was preserved within the Sufi orders, was challenged. But they had to be a bit careful about that if they didn't want to give up their lives because of the difficulties of the time. And I thought when I picked up the book, it might be one of those saying, I'm speculating that. But no, he's got really good translations of texts, particularly of Shams el-Tabriz and Rumi, that have always been there, but the Ottoman Empire largely said, you don't translate those, you don't study those, you know, it's kind of the forbidden library. Well, now, of course, you can get it and translate it. And so, also, I think he's being great, because he's not saying, so therefore, the rest is rubbish. He's saying, look, this is a perspective that the tradition has on Rumi and Shams. I'm saying here's an alternative based on these texts. And I don't want to knock this. But if you want to get really, try to understand what Shams and Rumi, it's very close to form is emptiness. Yeah. Emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness. And those ideas they got from Kashmiri Shaivism, Advaita Vedanta and Buddhism.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. No, but in exactly the same way, Rumi and Shams did not see the divine as something transcendental, as something other, as something out there. But the conventional and the ultimate reality were inseparable. You know, two conceptual isolates of one process or experience. Exactly as you say. Yeah, that's a very good, good observation. Anyway, so is that...
Yeah,
but it's fascinating speculation, yeah. And I'm letting it go because I like it. But it moves away, trying to say, well, if we come back, how does it have a bearing on this? Does holding one view or the other? I suppose if you held a strong theist view, then you might say so. Because you'd say it's not a problem at all. It's because God gave man free will and he rebelled, so he's been naughty. Yeah. Gets what he deserves, you know.
Yeah, I'm
yeah, and also what I was saying about, you know, the grand illusion of consciousness, from if we're going to translate that into the Buddhist perspective, it's talking about the way consciousness works conventionally. That's remaining, because that's scientific evidence about the way consciousness works. And you can see where there are similarities and analogies with the Buddhist analysis of consciousness. But there's going to be different explanations as to how that continuity works and what is the nature of the ground, if you like, that it arises out of. Does that make sense? And in certainly in terms of Buddhist philosophy, some are going to be very austere about that, and some are going to be richer. And it's far too crude a way of putting it, but the more austere ones are worried that the ones with a richer and more positive ontology about the ground of being are going to smuggle God in by the back door. And those that may or may not want to do that fear that those who are more austere negate too much and they're tipping towards nihilism, you know. But this is like a cartoon character of the debate. What I think is really good is if those two positions keep dialoguing and having dialectic with one another and don't try to shut one another out of the debate or stop doing it, then in the dialectic of the philosophical argument, there'll be a convergence towards a better understanding in words, you know, of what emptiness is all about, kind of respecting the fact that ultimately it's ineffable. And there was a point I was actually going to make that I had in the notes, which is sort of quite an important one, and that's His Holiness also raises it in here. And let me see if I can find it. Anyway, I think I can remember it anyway, so I don't need to. It's like the idea that you hear the idea, and it's very strong in Buddhism, right back to the Pali Buddhism, that ultimate reality is ineffable. Yeah? So if you then start talking about philosophizing about emptiness or meditating on emptiness, it's kind of, well, how can, if reality is ineffable, how can you do that? Or what's the point? You know, it just sort of makes no sense. So some would abjure philosophy altogether, you know, so just a nonsense because, you know, get on with it. And they'll cite the 10 questions the Buddha wouldn't answer and so on and so forth. But the point is holiness makes in here, which is a very good one, is that kind of realizing emptiness as it's directly experienced in meditation may not be able to be put into words. That experience may defy articulation. Yeah, you'll never adequately express it in words, but that doesn't mean that emptiness can't be reflected and meditated upon. And in fact, the one will help. What's being said? In fact, it's good you point that one out, because this is true of reality at every level, whether we're in an argument about its ultimate nature and emptiness or whatever else. So, but does that mean it's not worth talking about it or not worth examining perception and what red is and all of that? No, it's not. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, it's also, it's echoed in 20th century philosophy by Wittgenstein in the Tractatus, who said, if there's all these problems about, you know, what's nonsense and what's not nonsense, why speak about things that can't be spoken about? Some things can be said, other things can only be shown. It's the same. And if you go back to those, I think if you wanted to look it up, it's like the 10 questions the Buddha wouldn't answer. Because it's interesting, because some areas he seems in his teaching, you know, quite enthusiastic and quite keen to engage in a bit of philosophy. But there, when it gets really, really into the areas of speculative metaphysics, he's like, sorry, don't want to go there. Because, and he's not, you know, he's not doing it in a, oh, you know, thou shalt not way. I think he's just kind of recognising that that's just going to go round and round like a Catherine wheel going nowhere, you know.
So you're saying it's okay not to know and that's it now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit, and you know, when I was, remember, I think it was yesterday or the day before, I was saying of Lama Yeshe, that in the kind of idealist or not idealist argument, saying, well, oh, maybe there's something out there that we can't even know about. And he's saying, well, there may or may not be, but if we can't know about it, what does it matter?
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of, It's a pragmatic approach to a metaphysical undecidable. Saying, well, okay, we hear all that, but here we are still suffering. Let's get on with what we can do. No? It's kind of, so, yeah, it's a great observation. More study, more stuff needed, and my opinions are never, ever final. All I'm doing is sharing my opinions, but it's worth digging into yourself. Well, that's back to Nagarjuna, who's saying, who was, an astonishing philosopher, not just in Buddhist terms, but in the history of Indian philosophy. He was just a stunning and towering figure, and yet he was the one that said, attachment to views is folly. Don't be attached to views. Then the medicine becomes poison.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wittgenstein had that very much, sometimes denigrated, and saying, it's a therapeutic, kind of therapeutic idea of philosophy. But there's a metaphysical itch to know, who am I, where am I, where have I come from, what's it all about, and all of that. Mm-hmm. And Wittgenstein said the purpose of philosophy is not to give you an answer to that, but to let the fly out of the bottle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Job done. Yeah. Yeah, that's another fruitful area. It went down a bit, but back in the late 60s and 70s, there was quite a lot of good comparative philosophy done on Wittgenstein and Buddhism. Mm. Let's hope dialogue and convergences will go in that direction a bit. Anyway, we've stayed a lot longer at it than we should have done, because it's 5:20, but I was very happy to allow that to go, because it was... I enjoyed that.